radioen, mm-hmm. så har du overblik over håret resten af programmet.
Ja, ja. Men det er også bare sådan noget med, hvornår jeg kan give dig lov til at tage dine headphones på, og hvornår.
Ja, jeg har fået lov at have på nu.
Ja.
Men ellers har jeg ikke hørt så meget af det musik, som...
Nej, det bliver en overraskelse, når du lytter til programmet.
Ja. Vi lyttede lige til... hvad var det nu lige, det var?
Altså, nummeret hed vist nok Jacinto. Eller, jeg ja. Tror, det er Jacinto.
Det var det med det lange kunstnernavn.
Ja.
Nortec Collective Presents Bis Bostige og Fusible.
Ja.
Et nummer, som du hedder Shazamet.
Ja, jeg fortalte lige, det er min, min bedste Shazam-moments, fordi at jeg hørte det. Jeg kan ikke huske, hvad det var, men jeg så en eller anden tv-serie, og så spillede de det i... Altså, der var en, der tændte for radioen i baggrunden, og så var der en anden, der sagde, ah, sluk for det lort, eller et eller andet, og gik hen og slukkede. Så det var ultra kort klip. Det var i baggrunden, og de snakkede henover.
Spolede du så tilbage i
ja,
tv-programmet?
Det var jeg lige nødt til.
Og så shazamede du radioen inde i tv-programmet?
Ja, så shazamede jeg ligesom bare hen til højtalerne, ikke? Men altså... Nogle gange så Shazam fandme magisk.
Det er det.
Jeg kan ikke rigtig forstå, hvordan de har gjort det.
Det er noget med algoritmer.
Ja, noget med algoritmer.
Martha, hvad er den fedeste frisyre, du har klippet, tror du?
På et andet menneske?
Ja, eller på dig selv?
Det ved jeg ikke. Jeg kan ikke rigtig huske, hvad jeg har...
Du har ikke givet din mor spikes?
Nej. Måske det er lettere at sige, hvad den mest sådan, tvivlsomme frisyr, jeg har givet nogen. Det tror jeg er lettere end at sige den fedeste. Det var min ven Dennis. Jeg ved ikke, om Dennis han lytter med. Da vi var sådan noget 16 år. Og han havde sådan noget sådan meget blondt, sådan meget lige. Jeg vil ikke sige, det var slasket, men du ved, det var ikke ligesom dit. Der var ikke sådan så meget krøl og struktur i. Og så tror jeg, der var nogen, der overtalte ham til, at han skulle have sådan... Jeg ved ikke, om det var en hanekam, men det var i hvert fald noget undercut-situation. Og så opførte det sig bare slet ikke, som vi troede. Så det var bare sådan en meget plasket undercut-situation.
Et plasket undercut?
Ja, og så tror jeg endda, at der var nogen, der sådan, fik en idé om, at der skulle også lidt hænder i, så han fik også sådan en rød stribe eller sådan noget. Ja. Og det var lige en Roskilde Festival.
Der det var tvivlsomt.
Det var tvivlsomt. Der er et meget fedt billede af ham, jeg kan huske fra den. Det var års Roskilde Festival.
Ja.
Mm. Men altså, Dennis, han ser skide godt ud nu.
Okay.
Han er kommet efter det. Ja.
Okay, ja. Det er ikke sat sig.
Nej. Han går kun i hvidt tøj.
Okay.
Det er hans ting.
Ja,
kun hvidt tøj. Altid kun hvidt tøj. Fra top til tå.
Wow.
Mm.
Jeg har hvide bukser på nu.
Ja. Og en blå trøje.
Jeg har spildt på dem.
Noget, der ikke er hår, har du spildt?
Ja, ja, altså, der er kommet pletter på.
Nå ja, men det er jo life.
Ja, det tænker jeg også.
Ja. Skal vi høre noget musik?
Det skal vi. Skal vi høre det langt, eller mellem langt?
Men jeg tænkte, om vi måske skulle høre det der... altså, det er ikke for at sælge sin til mig, men det er Martha and the Muffins.
Det er rigtigt. Det havde vi faktisk lige aftalt.
Men det er et nummer, der hedder Swimming.
Det kommer her. Det var en fejl, der trykkede.
Men det er fint.
Det kommer her.
Der er en intro.
Sound of parks and simple places. Sense the thickness of the air, highly strung like nervous guitars. My fingers make waves in you. We're afraid to call it love. Let's call it swimming. We're afraid to call it love. Let's call it swimming. We're afraid to call it love. Let's call it swimming. We're afraid to call it love. Let's call it swimming. We're afraid to call it love. Let's call it swimming. We're afraid to call it love. Let's call it swimming. We're afraid to call it love. Let's call it swimming. We're afraid to call it love.
Martha, må jeg godt tage høretelefonerne på nu?
Ja, ja. Men nu deler vi lige mikrofonen lidt.
Du kan faktisk godt få din egen.
Okay. Jeg er rykket over på højre side igen.
Ja.
Ja.
Vil du give en opdatering?
På håret, eller?
Ja.
Jamen, altså, symmetrien er ved at være...
Mm.
Du har sådan lidt små hår i hele hovedet. Jeg kan ikke forstå, at du ikke... Det ville gøre mig helt vanvittigt.
Jeg har faktisk lidt fået lidt allergi.
Nå, af hårene?
Jeg ved ikke, om det er derfor.
Bare det ikke er det der mango-halløj, du drikker.
Nå. Vi har åbnet en mango-sodavand.
Ja.
Eller jeg har. Du har ikke åbnet din endnu.
Nej, jeg har jo haft hænderne fulde af hår.
Er du ikke interesseret?
Jeg er mega interesseret. Må jeg få den nu? Tak.
Det er den, der hedder sparkling mango.
Ja. Som du konkluderede var den bedste af... To forskellige mango-læskedrikke.
Verdens bedste ud af to.
Det er da heller ikke
dårligt. Inden fra bazaaren tæt på, hvor jeg bor.
Ja.
Skål, Martha.
Skål. Tak, fordi jeg måtte være her.
Og så tusind tak, fordi du vil være her.
Ja.
Det er en fornøjelse.
Det er blevet noget flydende med det der, med hvornår man laver radio og ikke laver radio efterhånden.
Ja. Vi ses primært, når vi laver radio.
Ja.
Og i dag har vi snakket om, at det er blevet lidt, det er meget stille, det musik, vi spiller.
Ja, det tror jeg, det næste nummer måske kan, altså det er ikke, fordi det er aggressivt eller noget, men jeg tror godt, det kan ruske lidt op.
Ja, det kan godt være, at vi trænger til at blive rusket lidt op.
Imens jeg lige børster lidt hår igennem.
Ja, det var i hvert fald meget inderligt, det musik, vi lige hørte nu.
Ja, det var sådan lidt lullende.
Ja, det hedder Ocean's Edge.
Men det var præcis sådan, det lød jo.
Ja, præcis.
Ja.
Tror du, at vi kan nå at klippe håret færdigt, inden programmet er færdigt?
Ja, og så tror jeg i værste fald, at jeg lige laver sådan en... Måske vi går ind i det rum ved siden af, hvor der er bedre lys, så kan jeg lige dobbelt-tjekke.
Ja.
Men ja, altså vi er så godt som der, hvor
I
vi skal være.
Der faktisk.
Mm.
Hvor mange numre tror du, du skal bruge for at...
det kommer an på, hvor lange de er.
Ja, hvis det nu er sådan i 3-4 minutter.
Ja, måske tre sange eller sådan noget.
Ja. Jeg har en sang, jeg gerne vil spille.
Ja, og jeg har som altid en kæmpe liste, så altså, jeg løber ikke tør, men det er bare det der med at vælge de rigtige. Men jeg tror måske, jeg har en sang, jeg tænker, vi skal slutte på, og der er ikke nogen sådan kontekstmæssig andet, end at det er en frihed, jeg vil tage mig, fordi... Må jeg sige, at vi optager på forhånd? Nu har jeg sagt det.
Det må du gerne.
Det er i dag tirsdag.
That we are all here, yes, I switch my case, of which I'm certain. I've lived a life that's full, I've traveled each and every highway, yeah, yeah, and there's much more than that. I did it my way.
Yeah. de ce musicien. C'était l'automne à la maison. Je me souviens de ce musicien. C'était l'automne sur son violon. Le temps n'est plus où passaient les violons quand tu étais dans la maison. Il attend plus depuis tant de saisons. Le temps n'est plus au violon. Moi, dans ma maison-ville, dans ma chambre-ville, je passe l'été à écouter cette symphonie qui était si belle et qui me rappelle un amour fini. Moi, dans ma maison-ville, dans la chambre-ville, je passe l'été à regarder les oiseaux qui passent comme des menaces et chantant le temps, moi je n'attends personne. De ce musicien, un soir d'adieu à la maison. Je me souviens, moi, de ce musicien et de l'adieu sur son violon. Et chaque année, lorsque l'année finit, j'entends le violon de septembre. Et le passé, comme une symphonie, fait son entrée dans cette chambre. Je passe la nuit à écouter cette symphonie aujourd'hui finie et qui me rappelle que tu étais belle. Moi, dans la maison vide, dans la chambre vide, je passe ma vie à regarder les photos qui passent comme des menaces. Et j'entends le toc, moi je n'attends personne. Moi, dans la maison vide, dans la chambre vide, je passe ma vie à écouter cette symphonie.
Welcome to Hard Talk on the BBC World Service with me, Stephen Sacker. At the age of 19, my guest today made a fateful and in many ways unlikely decision which transformed her life. Back then in 2007, Manning was troubled, rebellious, jobless, sporadically homeless, and desperate to make a fresh start. The US Army was a strange choice, not least because to be openly gay or transgender was an offence under its Don't Ask, Don't Tell policy. But Manning had skills in computing and data analysis, which the military was very keen to use. Within 3 years, she was sent to Iraq at the height of the insurgency against the US occupation. Manning's job was to collate and interpret vast amounts of data and intelligence. It provided access to a vast store of confidential information about the US wars in both Iraq and Afghanistan, going back years. So Manning downloaded this intel trove and sent it anonymously to WikiLeaks. The material made global headlines around the world, embarrassing the US government and, according to the Pentagon, compromising vital security interests. Within months, Manning was arrested, imprisoned, and eventually put on trial, charged with 22 offences. The result, a 35-year prison sentence. Chelsea Manning fought a long battle to get her gender transition recognised whilst inside prison. President Obama gave her clemency in 2017, and she is now a digital activist and advocate for transparency and equality. Can transparency ever be a justification for spilling state secrets? Well, Chelsea Manning joins me now. Welcome to Hard Talk.
Thanks for having me.
It's a great pleasure to have you. If I may, I want to begin with the decision that really changed, transformed your life. That is the decision to sign up to the US military.
Right.
Why did you do it?
So in 2007, My father and I had a falling out, and I was living in Maryland, and I had just been houseless for about a year. And I decided that, you know, working in various jobs and, you know, trying to go to school wasn't enough for me. And also, as a trans person, I was trying to figure out who I was. And so I had a lot of identity issues, mm-hmm. all sort of happening at the same time, you know, and wanting to rebuild my relationship with my father, who was in the Navy, and also this war being discussed continuously and ongoing. It was a dinner table conversation. The Iraq War at the time, as well as Afghanistan to a lesser extent, being an ongoing thing, I decided, based on my father sort of suggesting that I enlist in the Navy, I decided I wanted to be a little different and try to enlist in the Marine Corps, but the recruiters weren't there on that day, so I ended up enlisting in the U.S. Army.
Even within that story, there are all sorts of red flags to me, but
right.
suggest that you're actually perhaps one of the most unsuitable people I could possibly think of to actually go and serve in the U.S. Army in Iraq. I mean, you talk about the wrestle with your identity, which we'll talk more
right.
about later, but also you'd been homeless for a while,
mm-hmm.
you were very lost mentally, your mental health was fragile, you had a poor relationship with your parents. On all of those bases, as well as being quite a rebellious person, the idea of going into uniform, accepting the authority of the U.S. Army, seems like the last thing you needed at that particular time.
Well, I mean, other people would make the suggestion that that's exactly what you need at that time. So, then that was what my father was suggesting, and that's what the military itself was even suggesting.
But were you just really trying to escape from the reality of your life
sure.
as it was then?
Sure. I think that's why a lot of people at that age enlist in the military.
In your memoir, it's a very candid mm-hmm. memoir, and you describe how you really struggled with basic training, with lots of different aspects
right.
of being in the military. And in fact, the military nearly threw you out long before you got to Iraq, but you just about scraped through. And they recognized mm-hmm. in you some skills, particularly computing skills, data analysis skills,
right.
which they desperately needed at that particular time.
Right.
Do you think that they, in a sense, swallowed their major suspicions and reservations about you just because of the skills you brought to the table?
Sure. The U.S. military at that time frame, was very short-staffed. They were obviously trying, one of the things to try to encourage people to enlist in the military at the time was they were offering these gigantic bonuses. I mean, I think it was offered $20,000, and some of my other peers were offered $40,000 at the time in order to enlist. There were people who were leaving the military and being called back up and, as a stop loss to continue to have people in the office. Many people in my position as well, were basically having their sort of issues looked at, ignored or given a second chance or, put into a slightly different role to sort of shake things up. Yeah.
Right, because you were obviously destined to go to Iraq to do data analysis, to work in intel in one form or another.
Right.
You were warned, weren't you, about the dangers of leaking, of exposing information to the outside. You were also warned, I believe, about WikiLeaks in particular.
It was brought up I was brought up by a contractor, a civilian contractor who was training us. They mentioned it, and it was just sort of a thing in passing. I do recall that happening. I didn't really dig into it at that point. It was like 2008, so.
Right, you didn't dig into it, and yet within weeks of arriving in Iraq, you'd reached out to WikiLeaks, and you'd clearly made a decision to cross the most fundamental line of all, to actually reveal this confidential secret information.
I don't think that comports with the timeline, necessarily. I think that I spent, quite a bit of time in my job and in my role. And obviously I was in various...
Well, I think by the end of November, you'd only arrived there a month or so earlier. By the end of November, you'd made the initial contact with WikiLeaks.
That doesn't comport with my understanding of the events, no.
Well, it's the timeline that was put into the court, and that appeared
right.
to be established by the computer records.
That's not the timeline that I'm familiar with. So I recall the upload coming up in January, but the first time that I ever, uploaded anything or released anything was in January.
Right. Well, yes, that's when you actually release things. I'm talking
right.
about the initial contact. But let's not quibble about a few weeks, because it doesn't really actually matter that much.
I think it matters because, I had some time to settle into my role. I had
right.
some time to really learn things and experience things.
So what was it that motivated you to cross that most fundamental line? In essence, to steal secrets and send them not just to anybody, but to WikiLeaks, where you knew they would be exposed to the whole world.
Well, I mean, I tried to reach out to the New York Times and the Washington Post as well. So, this was one of the things that I envisioned was a sort of a physical handoff to, a journalist in, a kind of a Woodward and Bernstein style handoff in parking garage or something along those lines. So that's why I went to the U.S. during my leave and tried to contact conventional journalists.
Right. In the end, you used a computer in a bookshop, I believe, to dispatch this information. And we should say vast, vast amounts of information. The so-called Iraq war logs and the Afghan war diaries amounted to hundreds of thousands of separate pieces of information, right?
Right. But I mean, I worked with tens of millions of records every single day. So this is still even a fraction of the kinds of information that we were collecting and using.
I don't doubt that, but what I'm getting to is the point that as these were hundreds of thousands of files, there is no way in the world that you'd sifted them, filtered them. You just dumped them.
No, I wouldn't characterize it as that. The way that I view this is, these are categorical types of information. So you have information that, and this is obviously types of information that I'm very familiar with, that I have worked that, I was essentially one of the most familiar with because we were the ones that really had to categorize this information, put it into subcategories, direct where it flows, train an artificial intelligence algorithm to be able to make predictive analysis based on. So I think that I was very familiar, and I certainly knew tens of thousands of
types of information. And
right.
This was information going back 5 years to the engagements in Afghanistan and Iraq of the U.S. military. You knew the categories.
I think 6 years.
You knew the types, the categories. But what I'm getting to is you didn't go through these files to look at the individual stories they told. You couldn't possibly. There were far too many. We know you didn't. And that gets to the heart of the ethics of this case. You just put this information out there, gave it to WikiLeaks, not having examined it yourself and not knowing that actually it did include some information which named individuals, which compromised individual security.
The U.S. government wasn't able to show, they didn't show that in court. So they made this allegation in 2010, but it appears that in 2011, whenever the Information Review Task Force reviewed this information, that it was a different type of information that I had access to that they included because they assumed that everything that I had access to was potentially leaked. But, and I did have access to source identifying information and I did have access to human intelligence reports, but those were not included in the records.
Right, but you see, once it was out there and WikiLeaks in the end dumped this information into the public domain, because of course you had no control over what WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, and the rest of them were going to do with it, they chose in the end to dump this information
into
the
public domain.
If they hadn't,
then I would have done the same thing. I would have posted it.
And you say that now,
BitTorrent,
knowing what we know. The media, for example, went through this information. This is back in July of 2010 when you did the first big dump was put into the public domain. The Times newspaper found the names of dozens of Afghans credited with providing detailed intelligence to U.S. forces. The Taliban then went on the record saying, we are analyzing all of this data and we will take retribution against those individuals that we find in this reporting from WikiLeaks.
Right.
Amnesty International and the Open Society Institute then said, we have seen the negative, sometimes deadly ramifications for those Afghans who have been identified. That was all your work.
Right. And again, we went through a court-martial process and those allegations didn't show up. They made the allegation that, obviously the Taliban said that they were going to retribute against people. And then the government couldn't identify anybody who was held accountable or.
So as far as you and your conscience are concerned, the fact that you don't know of specific individuals who were
killed. We weren't given a list of individuals who were placed at risk. This just didn't happen.
Well, they clearly were placed at risk. Whether or not retribution was eventually delivered to those people is another matter.
But there's no list of names for us to go through. We asked for it during our court martial.
But the media found these names. I mean, it was quite plain.
Well,
it wasn't presented before the court. But even if it wasn't presented before the court, and I'm not answerable for what the prosecution did or didn't do, is it on your conscience that these names, you didn't sift the information. It turns out you did put names into the public domain. And I wonder now, having had many years to reflect on it, whether you regret that.
Well, no, I chose certain categories of information under the understanding of what is and should be in this kind of information.
Categories. In a sense, you put lot of trust into WikiLeaks and Julian Assange. Do you regret that?
I would, if they were not available, I would have uploaded this information separately. I was in a position where if I didn't have a publisher of last resort, because I was struggling with the New York Times. I was struggling with the Washington Post. The Washington Post was the one that I really wanted to get to, the one that I had the most sort of interaction with. Then I was going to, you know, use some other tool like BitTorrent or something like that to post this information, which would have been, that would have been my even more of a last resort. That would have been my more desperate.
Right. You did the war logs and the war diaries dump, and then you then released all of these diplomatic cables, which had different kinds of information, secret, confidential information involving the U.S. government's contacts with individuals on the ground in a whole host of countries. Just to take one small example, but not small to the individual involved, an Ethiopian journalist, reporter, Argu Ashin, was forced to flee the country because he was named in a U.S. cable, and he believed it put his life in immediate danger. He had to flee, leave his homeland. And again, wouldn't have happened had you not taken your decision to leave.
Again, you know, you're talking about situations that I'm not familiar with that weren't brought before a court.
But that's the point. You weren't familiar with them because there's no way you could have gone through the information. You just, to use the word again, dumped it. And after all these years, I'm fascinated to know whether there's a part of you that thinks you got it wrong.
I mean, I don't think I've got it wrong. I think that this information needed to be made public. I think that any method that was made available, I would have taken. There was nothing that was going to stop me. There was no, like, if I didn't have anyone to go to and I was running out of places, I would have done this completely on my own.
In essence, are you saying you don't believe in the legitimacy of intelligence gathering, of secret government activity in the name of national security? Because Michael Rubin, a former Pentagon official, after all of this, particularly the diplomatic cables, which upset him so much, he said Manning not only burned the sources of hundreds of diplomats around the world, she effectively dissuaded foreigners from ever trusting a future American official.
Well, on the other hand, you have Robert Gates, who basically says that this is nothing. This is a nothing burger. There's not this. This is not. This is. This has no impact on the diplomatic relationship with the United States. This is a Secretary of Defense.
It's not quite what he said. He said, in the end, we will get over this, that outsiders, foreigners look at the US, they realize these things happen, but they're not going to stop talking to us. But fundamentally, I'm just asking you whether you believe or whether you care that you might have compromised important aspects of US national security and intelligence gathering, not least because, for example, one cable...
Well, for intelligence gathering, I don't think so, because, you know, the US intelligence apparatus is a large apparatus, is one in which, you know, there are many sources and methods that haven't been made public, that weren't even available to me.
Just a final one on the cables. There was one list of the most important national security sites around the world listed by US diplomats. And you, of course, you didn't necessarily know you were doing it, but you inadvertently released that to the world too. PJ Crowley, the State Department spokesman at the time, said you were effectively giving a targeting list to Al-Qaeda. Did that give you pause for thought?
I mean, look, we live in the age of radical transparency already. At this point.
But what does that mean, radical
what does that
transparency?
Mean? Well,
it doesn't mean you don't have a personal responsibility. And I'm asking you whether
I went through a court-martial process. I went through a court-martial process where evidence was presented before the court. We were given evidence. We were given discovery. We went through this process. I've taken responsibility. I've taken full responsibility for all of my actions. I've gone through this process.
You did, at the time of the court-martial, let's get to that, you did say that you recognized the damage you had done. So to this day, Do you recognize damage done?
Look, my job was essentially to make decisions in which I damaged people every single day. So among all of the decisions that I've ever made in my entire life, yes, I have caused, you know, some harm. I've killed civilians. You know, I've been involved in the death of civilians because I've made mistakes. This was just me doing my job. I was never held accountable.
Well, the leaking clearly wasn't you doing your job because... The military then decided...
I'm talking about the job that I was doing, in Iraq. I was an intelligence analyst. I did this every day.
I understand that. That was the
job. There are dozens of people not alive today because of the job that I did. And do I regret that? I mean, I feel that down in my bones, yes.
Let's talk about the way you were treated once you were apprehended. Because to be honest, you didn't really cover your tracks very well. I'm not even sure you intended to. Exactly.
Yeah.
You kind of...
I had a concern that at some point that my colleagues might get caught up in this and their careers might be affected.
So. Right. So you felt that wouldn't be fair. So your tracks were not well covered. You spent 3 years pretty much in prison before you actually got convicted. It seems to me, and again, the memoir is very frank, they tried to break you. How close did they come to breaking you, particularly with the amount of time you spent in solitary confinement?
Break me how? And
mentally,
why?
To the point where you, frankly, were no longer capable of mounting any sort of defense of yourself.
Well, I was surprised. I was shocked. I didn't expect this experience or this treatment. I certainly thought that the risk to me was that I could lose my job, that I could be discharged, that I could lose my security clearance, which at that age and
in fact, you were kept in a steel cage for a while in Kuwait. And when you got to the United States again, you spent many months in solitary confinement. I talked about breaking.
I've had no contact with my lawyers. I had no contact with the outside world. I didn't even know who won the World Cup.
At a couple of points before your eventual release in 2017, you were so desperate you tried to take your own life.
Yes.
That sounds like you were broken.
I mean, well, I don't know because that time period is just it's blended together so much. I don't remember a whole lot about my time period in Kuwait because I just remember being in this hot steel enclosure with two or three Navy personnel watching me at all times, telling me different bits of information if they did talk to me at all, feeding me, and it being very hot. And I have I don't know that I'm facing charges. I don't know that I have a lawyer or that I'm facing that there's any end to this. And so, and it all started to blend together because I don't even know what time it is because it's the same lights all day. Like I can't see the sun. I have no idea what's going on.
But I'll tell you what's so striking about this. As you say, you didn't know when, how the end would come, but
right.
You had the strength, despite all of this, and despite, mm-hmm. obviously, the mental trauma you were going through, to fight not just the case, which we've gone into in some detail, but you also made a stand for your own identity. You demanded that the military, this is after conviction, but you were facing
right.
a long prison sentence, you demanded that the military system and the government recognize you as transgender,
mm-hmm.
give you hormone treatment,
yes.
and if they would not, you said, I'm going on hunger strike.
Yes.
To death.
Yes.
And in fact, they bent,
mm-hmm.
and you became the first ever prisoner in military custody to get hormone therapy
U.S.
treatment.
Military custody.
Yeah. Is that more important to you in a way than this sort of advocacy for transparency that you're involved in?
I mean, they're different, obviously. I think it's more important for me personally that I be who I am and that I have some, you know, because after my court-martial and after I faced responsibility after I faced accountability and you know, took responsibility for everything, and I had a sentence and I was given, you know, numbers is sort of the phrase.
Well, let's face it, you were given 35 years.
Yeah, but it's numbers. It's a number that you can count down mm-hmm. from. It's not life without parole. So now it was a matter of improving the quality of life and ensuring that I can make it through and survive this. And I don't think I would have, I don't think it would be realistic of me for me to have survived in the 32 years not having access to the care that I needed at
yeah.
the time.
The troubled mind you had as a young person seems to me you still have in a way. Because again, very candidly, you told the Guardian newspaper really recently that you felt in some weird ways that the army and prison as well were places where you felt you fitted in a
right.
way that you don't even feel you fit now that you're free and living that varied life in the United States of America.
It feels like very unstable in the U.S. is what I'm trying to get at. You know, the lack of... You know, knowing that you're going to have housing, knowing that you're going to have health care, knowing that you're going to have food, knowing what tomorrow brings. I don't know what tomorrow brings.
You feel a deep sense of insecurity.
I do.
You, Chelsea Manning, feel that insecurity every day, even now.
I'm feeling it less because I'm, you know, obviously establishing myself and having more of an assertive role in my life. And now I'm sort of learning how, you know, credit systems work and how, you know, how to pay rent and do, you know, pay bills and things like that. So I feel a bit more secure, but there's always a sense of like, I had more of this sense of belonging and security when I was with the inmate population in prison than I do outside in this very alienating world where we're just constantly, you know, communicating with each other over phones or, you know, like interacting with it, where everything feels like every interaction feels like it's commodified in some
right.
way, like it's a product.
And let's end just with a thought about America.
Right.
You signed up to serve America, as I said at the very mm-hmm. beginning. You now live a civilian life in America, and you say that you wanted to show the world the conscience of individuals can make urgent change through bravery and determination. Do you believe you've played a little part in changing America?
You know, I think that America's changing, and it's changing rapidly. Whether or not I have been a part of that or not, I'm not sure about. I want to believe that people as individuals can do that, and I encourage people to. It doesn't have to necessarily be something as big or as ambitious as, you know, the events of 2010 or anything like that. But I do believe that, you know, people in their own way, because like every moment of your life is a decision. Like, whether or not, when you're not doing something and whenever you are deciding not to participate in something, you are actively making a decision. Not doing something is a decision. It is a political action. And I believe that, you know, we have some responsibility in order to act in these kinds of situations. And sometimes it's messy.
Chelsea Manning, we have to end there. But thank you so much for joining
me
on Hard Talk. Thank you. I'm not afraid of the dark.
heard.
Hey, how long have I been up here? How many times? How long have I been up here? 23 months.
She marched down to Fenario. As we marched on to Fenario, our captain fell in love with a lady like a dove. They called her by name, Pretty Peggy-O. What will your mother think, Pretty Peggy-O? What will your mother think, Pretty Peggy-O? What will your mother think when she hears the guineas click?